Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bhumika, the host of the channel for today. And today, I'm delighted to be talking to Dr. Sarah Smith, who has authored not one, but two books this year. And I will say more about that. Sarah is a professor, an associate professor in the Department of Geography at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She is a political geographer who's interested in the relationship between territory, bodies, and the everyday. And of the two books that Sarah has published this year, we are going to be talking about this fabulous book published by the Rutgers University Press in a series called The Politics of Marriage and Gender, Global Issues in Local Contexts. And the book title is I love the title of the book, and we'll talk to Sarah more about the title and the book cover, which is, I wish you could see it, it's equally fabulous. The book is called Intimate Geopolitics, Love, Territory, and the Future on India's Northern Threshold. Congratulations, Sarah. We're so glad to have you here. Welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you so much, and it was so kind of you to invite me. I really appreciate it, Bhumika.
Fantastic. Sarah and I have had a bit of back and forth, deciding about the time. This has been a strange year for all of us, and I'm glad this is finally happening. And perhaps it is not only coincidental that this conversation is also happening in the backdrop of a border dispute between India and China, primarily in the Ladakh region, where Sarah has done much of her field work. But we'll come to that in a bit. And before we get to the book, I actually want to invite you, Sarah, to tell us a little bit about your journey in academia, your journey in geography, your journey to Ladakh, your journey with this project, or the many sort of projects that you've been doing for a long time. So yeah, your many journeys, actually, and it would be lovely for us to get to know about your various path and pathways into academia and scholarship.
Let's see. So it's a typical story, I think, for geography, in that I came to geography without knowing anything about it, which I think is normal for Americans. So in, I guess, around 2001, I was thinking, I was up in Ladakh and I was working there with the person who I would marry. We were working with a local NGO and feeling just a little bit frustrated with what we knew about the broader picture and how we understood our work in Ladakh, which often felt frustrating, working with local women trying to understand how they could transition to a new economy. But so many other things were going on, and a lot of NGO work can just start to feel really frustrating and like you're going in circles. So we thought we needed a broader perspective and decided really naively to go to graduate school. And I wanted to go back home. So I wanted to go back to Arizona. And when I researched, I ended up in geography only then. I had never taken a geography class in my life. So that was all completely accidental. once I was there and learning from especially Sally Marston about political geography and the ways that our day-to-day life is caught up in things like nation state, nationalism, and territory, I started to see the world in a really different way, and it was very compelling to me.
So I mean, that does sound like a lot of us who go to graduate school disenchanted by the world, and then perhaps get a little more disenchanted by the world when we are in graduate school. So tell us about your journey to Ladakh as well, where it seems like you were already embedded in other forms of work and engagement before you embarked onto sort of this more, you know, rigorous research project for academia.
Sure. Yeah. So I first went to Ladakh in 1999, and that was, of course, really shaped by then. It was the Kargil War. So my experience was of being told before arriving that Ladakh was a really dangerous place, perhaps you shouldn't go. And then, of course, from the moment that our airplane landed, it didn't feel like that at all. So my introduction to Ladakh was also shaped by this geopolitical storyline in the background, in contrast with how it felt to be in Ladakh at that moment, which was quite different. When it comes to the way I came to the book, it's interesting that at that time, arriving there as a stranger, so many things that were geopolitical were happening, but they were such that a visitor to Ladakh wouldn't really see them if you weren't able to speak Ladakhi or be kind of in these kitchen conversations where things are very geopolitical in their own way, but I don't think it comes across to outsiders because you don't understand sort of the gossip, which is key to understanding how people are relating to these larger forces. So at that time, I did a volunteer project and came to know folks there and ended up working for the local Women's Alliance. And got to know Ladakh in a really specific way through hanging out with just ordinary folks thinking about how to make life better for people in the villages and so on and so forth. When it comes to the story of the book, I think that the book really starts in 2004, where 2004 was a year when I interviewed this couple that I start the book with, this Buddhist Muslim couple who ended up being separated. Yeah, exactly. So that was this year when I interviewed them, and I also had my wedding reception. Which is key to this story. I'm not just relating a random personal anecdote. So we had my husband is from Ladakh. We had gotten married in 2002, but typically in Buddhist families, you have like a little wedding, and then a couple of years later, you have a big one. So this was the big one. And I had interviewed this couple and seen their marriage get really destroyed by geopolitical forces. And then that same summer, I was wearing the parak, this turquoise headdress, and dancing at our wedding. And I'm a complete outsider. I'm wrong in every way. Trust me, my in-laws were not happy about their son. Their son's choice at first. It took a while to warm up to me. And then all of a sudden I'm at this wedding and people are celebrating our marriage. And in the background is this knowledge that this other couple who equally sort of in love with each other, equally close and intimate, had just been separated. And I kept thinking about the differences in that situation and the way that even though I was an outsider, I wasn't a geopolitical threat in a specific way in relation to the future of Ladakh. I was sort of irrelevant. So in that way, people could dance at our wedding where they couldn't for this other couple. And that really hit home for me in a specific way. For me to think through things as an intellectual and political project, I feel like it helps if I can understand them in relation to our sense of self and subjectivity and how we relate to one another. So that really struck me, and I kept thinking about it for years after, and really drove my dissertation and then the book.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think I've ever heard the word dancing at a wedding and geopolitics strung together so seamlessly in the same sentence. And it does reflect sort of, you know, the various ways in which you have been both sort of, you know, intimately, distantly, professionally, scholarly, politically engaged with this project, which is very, very, it's very well reflected in the writing of the book as well. And because I've read the book recently, it's kind of fresh in my mind. And, you know, I meant to ask you also, and you brought it up in your sort of, you know, when you were telling us about Fatima and Palzor and your own relationship and the small and big wedding. What is the legacy of this term geopolitical, right? Because like you're beginning to talk, the way we understand geopolitics, but the way also in which it seeps into kitchen conversations or marriages or who gets to be the deserving bride, are also intimately connected, like you are able to tell us. But for our listeners, I actually wanted to invite you to tell us or explain to us actually. What is the particular sort of conceptual context in which geopolitics is generally used, and what is that legacy, and what are the ways in which your own work engages and departs from it in the context of sort of love, temporality, and territory in Ladakh?
Sure. So I think when people hear the word when people hear the word geopolitics, I think they think about battle plans or military strategy and struggles for the nation state's kind of military dominance in the world. And that's how the term originates in intellectual thinkers who were tied up in state projects of empire, of imperialism, of maintaining geopolitical might in the global stage or on the global stage. So I think that that's how it has conventionally been understood. And if you look at older political geography textbooks, that's where we'll think of it too, as thinking through land power versus sea power and so on. And then in the 1990s, people take up geopolitics in a different way, thinking about it as critical geopolitics. And what they're doing there is drawing on the theory of that era to understand how the way that we map and write the world then makes the world. So when we say there's a Cold War and this is an evil empire, and we mark out the globe in terms of these different broad categories, that's not just demarcating what we find out there in the world, but that's making that geopolitical world and writing it into how we understand the world. And once we have those frames, we interpret everything through those lenses. And that's a really critical development. And then to add to that, a little later, we have a feminist approach to geopolitics, which has really influenced me. So that happens later, a little after 2000, when you have folks like Jennifer Heinemann and other folks start to ask, well, where are the people in all of this? Because after all, it's people who die in the war on Iraq, in the war on Afghanistan. It's, you know, ordinary men and women who are suffering through this geopolitical lens. And how did they experience this? What's the embodied life of geopolitics? It's not all this grand scale and from a distance. It's also being scared when it's the right weather for drone attacks in your village. It's also trying to understand whose bodies matter and when. Why is it that it's, for instance, men of a certain age who are automatically classified as enemy combatants when they're in an area where there's a drone strike. So these are questions that are about military strategy, but they're about how that's related to things like gender and race and how these things are understood and then enable these geopolitical strategies. So it's about really the embodied life of struggles for territory.
Thank you. And
to tie that to the book, actually, I should have tied that a bit better to the book. So when I first started doing this research, I think I had no idea, I'd never heard of the term feminist geopolitics. But what I did know was that when I was in Ladakh and I started doing research, when I asked questions about politics, people would start telling me about dinner parties. And that really struck me. So I would ask about the political relationship between Buddhists and Muslims and India and how these things were in relation to each other. And people would say, let me tell you a story about this girl. And she fell in love with this man, and she was Buddhist, he was Muslim, and now look what's happened to her. She's back home wasting away. She's so skinny, a shadow of her former self. And I would think, but my question was about politics. Now we've got this tragic figure of this woman whose life has been ruined. And it happened so quickly, and not just in one story, but in so many stories. So that really, it was people talking to me and telling me these stories that, of course, helped me to understand what I was seeing in front of me.
Thank you, Sarah. I suppose, the most predictably surprising thing about so much of our field work is our questions lead us and also mislead us into all of these territories. And you know, while I was reading your book, I was constantly thinking about, you know, the landscape in which you were doing your field work, the ways in which you were navigating various relationships in the region. And I, you know, for our readers who, and for our listeners who will get to the book, I also wanted to request you to tell us a little more about your fieldwork as well. And you were just beginning to, you know, allude to it. I think one of your respondents also talks about her own levels of, if I can call it that, nangpaness, like how much of an insider-outsider position a Buddhist married into a Muslim family, or a Muslim married to a Buddhist family, or a Kargili from in Leh, or a person in Leh in Kargil. So all of these sort of, you know, various mobilities and relationships that form the larger network of people that you are, you know, talking to and listening to and learning from. So I wanted you to tell us a little more about the various sets of relatedness and practice that you yourself were accumulating and navigating while you were doing fieldwork, and how did it sort of also shape these very, you know, like you were saying, these very these questions which seem very obvious, but the answers to which take you to dinner parties and weddings.
Sure. I think it's interesting. It's something that I think about a lot. And in some ways, it's a difficult and uncomfortable topic. And I've written about this elsewhere in this article called Intimacy and Angst, because I felt that because I had spent quite a bit of time in Ladakh, and because of the ways that I felt, due to the graciousness of my in-laws and my family members, I felt really at home in Ladakh, and I feel that people relate to me in that way. So as I mentioned in the book, people, I'll ask, oh, did you tell me more about your marriage? I know you had a love marriage. And they'll say, I know you had a love marriage. So you know what that's like. Or they would ask me questions about, well, when are you going to have a baby? So I think that there was a way that it was too easy for me to be welcomed into kitchens and homes, and in a way that I sometimes felt I didn't deserve that, or I don't know how to deserve that, because people were sort of so generous, telling me really intimate and personal stories, like many of which I, of course, didn't put in the book because it felt sort of like too much trust had been placed in me. And that experience actually led me to shift how I do field work. So now I guess I'll talk more about the new project later, but I sort of intentionally cultivated a home away from my family home in Ladakh, so that now I work more with the Ladakh Arts and Media Organization and folks like Tashi Murup and Rigzin Dolma, who was there when I worked there, and Manisha Ahmed. So all of these folks have helped me to have more of a professional home in Ladakh. And I think partly that was a response to feeling that I had accidentally received so much trust and generosity that it almost felt like too much to rely on. I have some uncomfortable feelings for the ways that people put trust in me, even when I disagreed with their politics. So that people will talk to me and tell me things because of personal or family connections, in ways where I might disagree. And then in writing the book, I felt this anxiety of, I really care for this person and I appreciate this person, and I don't know that they would agree with what I'm writing. So that was in some ways a little bit of a barrier to them writing.
It's interesting you said that, because I often I've been doing my field work in an area which is sort of familiar and distant to me, because my parents grew up in the central Himalayas in Uttarakhand, and so I have these networks of sort of both familial relationships and kin network, and I often also feel very critically uncomfortable with these, almost like you inherit some of that trust, right? And this sort of problem, it's both a limitation and an advantage in that sense, like you were just explaining. And I think I'm going to go and read that piece that you wrote, because I haven't. But even in the text of the book, it is, of course, these questions are not resolvable in that sense, but you do offer that opportunity to think about what it means to be doing fieldwork in positions of sort of kin, friendship, and trust, while at the same time looking at these things both intimately and critically. So thank you for offering that provocation, almost, actually. And that actually takes me to a question that I had thought of asking you initially. Is, can you, for people who may not be very familiar with sort of the political history of the region, can you tell us a little more about the year 1989, and if that in some sense, in your own historiography of fieldwork, in your own historiography of how this project unravels for you, and the stories that unravel and the lives and relationships that unravel, actually, of love and of kin and relationships. Can you tell our listeners a little more about what is it about the political moment in 1989? What is this sort of, this political history, which coalesces in that moment. From where on, it seems like your project also takes on a very significant meaning to talk about intimate geopolitics. So I'm sorry if it's a very daunting question to taste the political history of a region as complex as that. But I meant to say, if you could speak a little more to you positioning your project in respect to those histories, particularly with what I could read in the book was 1989 seemed like a very strong reference point.
Of course. Yes, and it's a complicated history. I think that when people think of this region, they think first of Kashmir and the way that Kashmir has sort of dominated the storyline about this area. And Ladakh itself has also often been thought in relation to Kashmir, and that sort of leads us to 89. So of course, in 1947, the state of Jammu and Kashmir becomes part of India in these kind of contentious circumstances. And ever since then, it's contested because, of course, both Pakistan and India have always thought of it as being sort of their birthright. So, of course, that already brings us, and I swear I'm coming to 1989. This, of course, brings us to the colonial heritage. And naturally, if I think about the ways that people's lives have been destroyed by geopolitics and the ways that this is complex and people are navigating their love life and their decision to have children in relation to geopolitics, of course, if I want to blame anyone, I really want to start with the British, which is, you know, necessary. So all of these questions can really be tied to the way that they managed, the way that they colonized, and the way that they wished to divide people up according to these different categories that wouldn't necessarily match with how they saw themselves, and the way that imperial strategies of conquering people and colonizing people were always tied up in drawing borders on their lands, on saying you're this kind of person and you belong with this kind of laws in this kind of a space. And the story of Ladakh is also that, even though on the one hand it feels quite, you know, you land and you're in a different world up there in the beautiful mountains and the blue sky and snowy peaks always and these little emerald valleys and everything is very beautiful. But it's also shaped by this history as being this borderland, and the ways that has shaped what's possible and not possible, even as people try to live otherwise. So in 47 at partition, of course, places were mapped out according to religious identity so that the places with Muslim majorities were meant to be East and West Pakistan. And then the places, the borders were drawn according to that sort of line. And then that has put in, not only in that context, but in so many contexts, these ideas that if only you could just map the borders and the jurisdictions such that there was some kind of homogeneity within these spaces, somehow so many other things would be resolved. But fortunately, people aren't homogenous anywhere. So this brings us to 1989. Ladakhis had been mobilizing in different ways ever since independence to require more autonomy. And they didn't want autonomy in the sense of breaking away from India itself, but rather they wanted more regional autonomy because the state of Jammu and Kashmir was this kind of colonial construction already. And as you can see, Jammu and Kashmir doesn't even have Ladakh in it. It's not like Jammu, Kashmir, and Ladakh. So Ladakhis had often felt like they were subsumed in the politics of the state. And then as the struggle for autonomy grew in Kashmir and those politics became intensified, I think a lot of folks in Ladakh, particularly Buddhist Ladakhis, felt that they were being dragged along into something that sort of didn't pertain to them. And they wanted greater autonomy. They wanted to manage their own development funding. They wanted to be able to have more Ladakhis in different government spots and so on. So that had been occurring, and Van Beek writes this history in a more detailed way than I do, because my primary interest is the kind of intimate life of these stories. But Ladakhis had been mobilizing for more autonomy along different lines. And then it's at this moment, 1989, where it's labeled, the struggle for greater autonomy for Ladakh is labeled as being specifically in a determined way about religious identity. So there starts to be more language of, we are religious minorities as Buddhists, and our concerns are not understood. So it's, we're a separate nation by all the tests, and including more this language of religious identity and specifically Buddhist identity. So in 1989, this is also a context where at the scale of India, there's concern about communal unrest. It's the beginning of this turn towards Hindu nationalism, taking a greater role in national politics. And it just seems, from when I talk to older folks, they're like, we started to understand this is how things get done. So even I, a Buddhist, people might say to me, even I, a Buddhist, I love my Muslim neighbors, but we have to understand how politics work. And politics work such that somebody told me, like, politics don't work if you just send these letters, but if people at the center, if the government at the center hears, oh, there's been a fire, or there's a chance of communal unrest, that's when you get national attention. So some people would tell me this was a strategy. So in 1989, what happens is a group of Buddhists under the auspices, especially of the Ladakh Buddhist Association, they declare a boycott of Muslims, meaning you're not going to buy things from them, go to their house for parties, really have anything to do with them. And this was, of course, you can't declare the need for a boycott unless people are totally intimately entangled already. Otherwise, if you're living separate lives, then you're already, you know, kind of segregated, and there's no need to declare such a thing. But here, the boycott was a real rupture because people had been marrying each other, had been buying bread, buying meat, working together as neighbors. All these things meant that people's lives were completely entangled. So this was a significant rupture that everyone talks about. And that's why this time comes up for me, because it occurs in oral history after oral history of Buddhists saying, I felt such shame when I saw my Muslim neighbor, because I knew in my heart this wasn't right. Or we would go visit them in the nighttime because it just didn't feel right. Or these stories of people kind of refusing to participate. So this was this moment when people who had lived together, I mean, the Muslim Ladakhis were as Ladakhi as other Ladakhis. So they had been living together for so long. And this was a moment when it became marked as a political struggle, that to kind of get attention, we had to draw these borders such that we could get greater autonomy for our place. And it's a time talked about with real heart. Break, but also as a time that people interpret differently in terms of was it effective, and to what degree was that effectiveness part because of the strategy of boycott or because the boycott ended. It's a little bit of a complicated history in how people talk about it, but it comes up again and again. And it comes up in the history of marriage too, because the last couple I had talked to that had a intermarriage that wasn't sort of disrupted had married in 1991, which was the kind of right before the boycott ended.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks for putting that so concisely. That was a masterclass in summarizing.
I don't know about that.
No, it truly was. Like, oh, I was like, I should have taken notes. And, you know, even when I was reading the book, I was constantly thinking about, you know, what does it mean to boycott, right? So and you said it so beautifully that boycotting something acknowledges pre-existing relationships and intimacies, right? So otherwise, what would be the need to call for any kind of boycott? And I put it in, and like you just said that, you know, the boycott ended in 1991. So I'm just trying to think about what does it mean to boycott someone, to boycott social relationships and intimacies? How are these active conditions of boycott created and reproduced? What ends boycotts and reproduces them? There's also in the book, you also talk about banning intermarriages as part of the boycott. So what does an ethnography of boycott, which has, you know, in hindsight, look like? I have another question related to that, which I'll wait for and hold on to. But I wanted you to sort of, you know, perhaps think aloud, and you've, I'm sure, already thought about it with us. How does one study the effect of something which has apparently ended, like the boycott, and what does it mean to sort of still perhaps hold some nostalgia, but also some guilt, but also some active imagining about what boycott has, what is the social life of that boycott, which lingers even though it may have formally ended?
It really does. It really does. And I thought about this especially because now I work more with young people, and I also had interviewed them for this project too. And I think that it struck me really nicely when I did, for instance, a small focus group where young people went out and they interviewed older folks in their neighborhoods about their life. And then we came together and we had a focus group about what they had learned. And they had also taken some pictures. And what was interesting in that moment was that these young people really, it made me think about how we teach and we don't teach history, because they would tell me, you know, we never learned about this in school. And part of that is this colonial model of education. Again, I blame the British, where you're really taught to the test. And if you're from a place like Ladakh, you're completely invisible in that education. You don't learn about your language, your people, your history, like in so many other colonized places. You learn things that are suited towards this test. And then you're at home. People don't necessarily want to tell these stories or talk about them, or they have their own complex feelings. So young people, when they had gone and interviewed folks, they would tell me, we hadn't really asked these questions or heard these stories. And we feel we this group of Buddhist and Muslim young people, feel so close with each other. We're classmates. We have all these relationships, and we can never, never imagine doing these things. But that was so tragic to me in this way when I heard it, because the older people I speak to also had you know, Muslim and Buddhist friends and felt so close and this could never happen. So it just gave me so much anxiety about the future, just thinking about the ways that these things replicate or that intimacy is more fragile than we would like it to be, I guess. But I think I'm getting a little away from your actual question. So when it comes to the social life of the boycott and the after effects, I think it's in that people, we get taught you're this kind of a person, and you're taught that in some ways in opposition to other kinds of people. And you might not be realizing until the crucial moment when you have to ask yourself who you're in solidarity with, you might not realize that you've been learning to define yourself in opposition to others until that moment when that other needs your solidarity and you're not there for them. So I think that listening to young people talk about this also gave me a different impetus to write the book. So when I started to write the book, as I said, I felt so much anxiety. I felt like, would these women I talked to who are in their 60s or 70s, would they see themselves in how I wrote about their lives? Was I being respectful even as I had concerns about the kind of political implications of their choices? And I started to write more clearly when I thought about the young people I'm working with now. So I've been doing this project with college-educated youth, young people who are studying in these cities like Delhi and Mumbai that feel in many ways like foreign lands. And then they come back and they see Ladakh in this different way. And they have also all these questions about why did my grandparents participate in this boycott, or why can't we just live together? And I felt like when I was writing, it helped me to have folks like them in mind. So I was thinking of people like this, these two young people, Taung Chuskit and Sanzen Angmo. They're young people who are thinking about women's reproductive health and how they can have generative conversations across generations about this in their village. So I thought about like, how would they read my words and how would they understand differently the choices that people in their mother's and grandmother's generation had made, and how these choices were made in this great contingency and in relation to this colonial heritage and in relation to this just really sincere desire for your child to have an easy and beautiful life. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's there is this ongoing life of this boycott where people might learn it not through history books, but more through behaviors they're told to enact or things they're told about how they're dressing or who they're hanging out with. And then I think it helps to try to understand how all those choices are made in this historical and geographical context.
No, thank you. Thank you for your response, because it brings me your work with the young college educated folks who perhaps some of them are even returning to work in Ladakh. And you point out some of those conversations in your last chapter of the book, and it made me think, and as you are very well aware of the work on sort of youth futures or discourses on action and aspiration, particularly in, let's say, in the Indian Himalayas, there's a sort of a lot of work on that, and I've been thinking about, you know, what is the perhaps the value, desire, and role of education in all of this, right? And if the one thread in your book is about sort of young love and romance, the other thread, which is very evident in the conversations, is about the desire for quote-unquote good education, which somehow is also at various occasions tied in with the possibilities of romantic love as well, because typically that's where people are finding people to fall in love with, right? So I was wondering, how do we think about education and love and reprosexual politics, so to speak, together. And I'm always reminded of Laura Ahern's fabulous work on love and literacy and love letters in Nepal, right? Where the widespread of literacy actually also was very agentive in both ways to help people describe and communicate their love to each other and fall in love and be able to express that through this exchange of letters and then also culminate in domestic marital relationships. So I wanted to think with you, and I wanted to sort of ask you to speak to your own experiences, because as you were saying, you are increasingly more involved in a more sort of professional or more sort of concerted and focused way with the young college-educated folks. What are these entanglements of desire of education and love, and what does it mean for both intimacies and geopolitics, especially in a region like Ladakh, where some of the stories that people hear outside are people who perhaps may come to Delhi or Bombay for education, but will go back to Ladakh to make it better, right? So what are these desires for Ladakh, for education, and for a certain kind of love that get entangled? And if you the way that you experience them on your own during your long sort of relationship with Ladakh and your research.
Sure. So it was interesting. So as part of the research for my book, I did a survey of about 200 women, asking them, how many kids did you have and did you use family planning? This was partly because people had told me, oh, Muslims don't use family planning, Buddhists use family planning. And then when you go out and talk to people, guess what? Everybody loves family planning. It's really popular, especially if your mom and your grandma, people were dying from having so many kids and there was high infant mortality. When the first gynecologist comes to town, you love her. You adore her. You use the highest quality of praise for that person who literally has saved your sister's life. So family planning is really popular, and that's tied to education, because who can afford to have a lot of kids when what that means is trying to get them educated to prepare them for God knows whatever is coming. So as I was doing that survey, I would be out in these small villages with somebody who had not completed their education or who had gone to school for a couple years. And then that woman would be telling me, I wake my child up at 5 and I make her study, and I can't help her, but I will make her study. And they're placing so much into that child, so much love and care is going into that child. And then at the same time, that mother can't say, when you get to Jammu, here's how you find who's a scammer and who's a really good coach who's going to help you. How can she help with that? She can't even help study for the exam. So parents are struggling to put together money from like selling milk or like doing all these extra jobs, going to work on a new road for a few days, doing all these things to invest this love and care into this child who's the future of their family. And then they're sending that child into completely unknown. So women would talk to me for so long about, we don't know what they're doing. Are they doing drugs? Are they just buying flashy clothes? Are they sleeping with people? Like, what's happening to my child beyond those mountains? And it made me wonder, what is happening to their child? It really made me curious. Not curious, but I just cared. I wanted to know. And then at the same time, I remember this conversation. I'll leave out the names, but I remember this conversation with one of our cousins up in Ladakh, where she was showing me all these pictures on her phone of her friends back in the city where she had studied. And she showed me all these pictures and she's like, look, none of them are from Ladakh, but all of them are. And then she used a racial slur for East Asian folks. She said, all of these are this slur, just like me. And it stuck in my mind. I was speechless. You're casually using a racial slur to explain why your friends are who they are. And the reason they're your friends is because they are also racialized in this specific way. So that really struck with me, the casualness of this comment and the fact that all her friends, so her friends were mostly from the Northeast, so she's Ladakhi. So the Northeast is so far, food's different, culture's different, so many things are different. But then she finds a home in these friends. So I was really struck by that. And around the same time, to my great fortune, I got contacted. This was a little bit after. I got contacted by this potential PhD student, Mabel Gergen. And I met her in the Delhi airport. That's a long story. I guess I can't get into. But anyway, we met and I started telling her. She was telling me about the work she wanted to do on Sikkim. And I told her how I wanted to do this project on young people. And I told her this story about the cousin. And she was like, Sarah, you're telling my story. So we ended up working together on this other project you're talking about. So when it comes to thinking about the role of education, it's so many different things because it comes with all this other process and practices and experiences. So it's interesting because in the book, when I first started thinking about education, I thought of it in the way people would tell me, as Muslims, we used to be bad Muslims. We weren't literate. We didn't have enough education about our religion, and we couldn't be good practicing Muslims. And Buddhists similarly would talk about how they understand Buddhism better, but then, and how this helps them further along their spiritual path. But then in other contexts, people would tell me the reason we fight is because of education. Education has made us small-minded. It's made us narrow-minded. It's made us see people in different ways. And now we no longer trust each other. And this way that you're describing, they'll say like, yes, I know I'm talking in this romantic terms about the past, but we can't live like that now. And it was describing time as this force that comes and overtakes us. And we have no agency to live the way that we used to live. And this is tied in how they talk about it to education, to literacy, to all these other things that teach you to live in a different way. And they both, folks both want to send their kids for education. They know that they need to, but there's also a sense of loss as though the world is unfolding in this way and we are just these pieces of it, which I found really poignant. When it comes to the other pieces of, so what are these kids up to? These young people, when they're in all these different cities, I mean, of course they're having all their own stories. I mean, it was interesting because Mabel and I came to it thinking in some ways about that experience of discrimination. But naturally, that's just one piece of everyone's life. And then it's been really beautiful to learn about all the other things that are going on or the ways that people cope with discrimination. So when we talk to young people, they are like, oh, yeah, of course I face discrimination. Let me tell you about this time that all these things happened to me. And then they're like, but you know what I love is to go to the art museum. You know what I love is how I learned to like dance with my whole body. This one, I'll leave out. I'll like protect the names of the not so innocent. But people would tell me, you know, like, oh, like in Ladakh, you dance this one way. In Delhi, people kind of dance with their foot. And then in Varanasi, it was like, I learned to dance with my whole body. And it's just interesting to hear the kind of joy and the life and the ways that people are determined to make this beautiful thing. Like each person is the protagonist of their own story. So they're weaving these experiences of discrimination and their desires to do something for Ladakh and their Ladakhi identity. They're weaving it into so many other parts of their story and trying to really forge their own future, even as collectively they're doing that in relation to the demands and desires of their parents and grandparents and the pressures of the neoliberal state and capitalism and all these other forces.
I think it's appropriate to give a shout out to Mabel at this point, saying, hi, Mabel.
Hi, Mabel.
We talked about you. I'll be sure to tag her onto this audio when it's uploaded. Because of the connection between how I got to know about you and your work. So she does deserve a very gratitudeful mention right now.
Absolutely.
When you were talking about young folks and their desire to do something for Ladakh, cultivating their own Ladakhi identity and forging their futures, at the back of my mind, I was also thinking about the kind of political discourse that, let's say, the current generation of Ladakhi Buddhists, Ladakhi Muslim men and women, young ones, are both inheriting and engaging with. And I ask this because I was trying to think about what are the kinds of both majoritarianism and minority sort of identity sentiments that are crucial again to the way in which the politics of Ladakh has unfolded, even more crucially to propel a demand for first autonomous hill council and then a Union Territory and the trifurcation that happened last year in 2019. So I'm trying to think of, keeping with the spirit of your own insights of these ideas about intimate geopolitics, what is the intimate or intergenerational geopolitics, if I were to frame the question like that? Are people engaging within the same way that, let's say, a certain generation of the Ladakhi Buddhist Association leadership did? The fact that the MP from Ladakh is a young Buddhist man, does that have any representational impact whatsoever on perhaps young Ladakhi Buddhist men and their ways of thinking about the future of the region? Is there an alignment or are there deep divergences with that project? So I'm just trying to think about, because your book is so also helps people, also makes sort of the future, the idea of a future, not just an open-ended question, but also looks at the ways in which the future is constantly imagined right now, right? So, and what are the ways in which that future is captured and managed? So I'm trying to think through in the current moment and what transpired in the most sort of, authoritarian way, particularly in 2019 in August and the trifurcation thereon, which seems like at one level to an outside observer, the culmination of a demand that Ladakh has held on for so long. But at the same time, also seems like if one were to keep an eye on both the celebration, but also, like you point out, I think also Mabel points out, and one of the things I read from her, the reservations with it as well, right? So I wanted you to give a sense of how a certain kind of majoritarian politics work in a region with deep minority sentiments, and what does it have? What can it tell us about it? What does it tell you about, actually, particularly in terms of these intergenerational intimate geopolitics?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I feel it feels so strange that we left just a few days before that happened. Of course, we didn't know that was going to happen. So we had been in Ladakh for the summer, and then we left and had just gotten back here before that all unfolded. And it was, I was, of course, seeing everything unfold through, you know, Facebook groups and WhatsApp updates and all of this kind of thing. And it was so strange to see it in that way too, because of the way that social media feeds kind of mix everything together. So I would be seeing these concerns and fears for what's happening in the valley, like what's happening in Srinagar. Are people okay? It's so scary to think about the ways that a place can be just cut off. And then at the same time in Ladakh, people celebrating this thing that they had been wanting forever. And it's hard not to be sympathetic, because there is this real sense of, you know, oh, you're up in Ladakh, you're trying to get a promotion at your job, you have to go to Srinagar for some time and you have to deal with this, that, or the other thing. Or, you know, posts being full of people from outside when you're already such a small population that, you know, people ask sometimes the students that I talk to, oh, do you need a passport to go to Ladakh? Or the other day there was this thing on one of the Ladakh Instagram pages where a screenshot of the news when people had some Ladakhi speaking and they had put down their Indian Ladakhis, like to specify that they were the Indian kind of Ladakhis, like there's some other kind of Ladakhis. So when you're marginalized in so many ways and then you have this experience of marginalization, I mean, don't you want autonomy? So it's so, I mean, I think it's the ways that our world has been geopolitically shaped by this form of sovereignty that's also always colonizing already, that makes it so, I don't even have a word for it, because it's not bittersweet. It's just that everything is so simultaneous, where your liberation might be caught up in some other's domination. And who or how are you to untangle that? In some ways, the world is set up like that, just like the people I mentioned a while ago who would tell me, well, the time itself is like that. So in some ways, I feel that when I look at the political situation, and I wish it feels uncomfortable to speak on it without having been there in person in roomfuls of people speaking, where, you know, I get together with young folks, like this workshop that Mabel and I did in 2017. And then in the room, of course, with young people, they're saying so many things, you know. So there, you might have a young man who's talking about this questions of autonomy and so on from a Buddhist perspective, but then also really wants to make sure that Muslims are part of the student association, and that going forward, his generation does things differently. And he might be working with a young woman who's like working with him, and they're trying to see like, yes, how can we make our student association so that it's inclusive, so that moving forward, we don't sow these seeds of division for a future generation. And then at the same time, in smaller conversations, the young woman might be asking, but yeah, also, why are all our politicians men? So all these things are, you know, unfolding in this way where people are understanding their relationship to the state and the state's forms of domination. I mean, in relationship to their own, you know, which part of Ladakh do they come from? Do they come from Changtung, which is completely underrepresented in terms of education, or do they come from Sham? And all of these other things are unfolding in ways where we can't really, people have individual trajectories in relation to the state, and then they're trying to do some new things, but have different material interests as well. And people have different things at stake.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Thanks, Sarah. I was thinking that perhaps it's my own misgiving about geopolitics as a term that I opened our conversation with talking about the border dispute with China. And actually, the way that this conversation has gone, I get a better sense of what intimate geopolitics actually, you know, gets at, because there are so many degrees and scales at which it is playing out, and you are able to capture those scenes and those scales which are not, if not left out, but are perhaps trivialized in the larger scheme of geopolitics. So thank you for that, laying out that insight. I have one other question for you before I ask you our final question for the podcast. I actually wanted you to tell us a little bit about the cover of the book.
Oh,
It is. It's so striking. I think one of the reasons why I decided to pick up the book was also because of the cover. And title. I just for our listeners, I'll put up a photo of the cover when we do the book, the podcast blog, so you can have a visual reference as well. But the cover is titled "Mountains Are the True Ancestors." Can you tell us a little bit more about the artist and why a cover about ancestors when you're talking so much about the future?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I just love the cover. So the cover is by this artist, Chema Dorje, and you can go to, he actually has started an art cafe in Ladakh. That's right, kind of near, just above the mosque. It's called Spindle, and it's such a beautiful place. Anybody who goes to Leh should go there right away. So I knew that I couldn't accept any other cover than a Ladakhi artist, especially I owe that really to my work with the Ladakh Arts and Media Organization that's directed by Manisha Ahmed, and then Tashi Murup runs it in Leh. And because of my work with them, I had seen so much beautiful art by Ladakhi artists who are working through these themes of what does it mean to be Ladakhi, among all their other personal themes, like their relationship to, you know, Buddhism or sexuality or whatever they're thinking through. So I knew that I really wanted to work with a Ladakhi artist. And then I had been looking through, I had talked to somebody from Lamo, Rinchen Dolma, and asked her who I should think about. And I had looked at a bunch of things. So I really liked this piece. I mean, I like all of Chemat's work, but I really like this piece because I like that it combines several different things. So you have like a little bit of a hint of the Tonka painting, which is really familiar to everyone, like a religiously oriented painting where you really do things in a prescribed way because the intent isn't to make a beautiful piece of art, but to kind of attain liberation from the world. So you follow a formula to get to that. So he's incorporated like a little bit of that, and then the mountain that's iconic for Ladakh. But then we're always told how the Himalayas were like under the ocean. And I've always been able to visualize in this strange way in my mind when I'm flying to Leh. I really feel as though you can feel that these mountains are still crashing into Asia. And, you know, they're supposed to be getting a little higher every day. So he talks about how the ocean in the center is about the past when Ladakh was under the ocean. And then he's made this collage with rice paper, and then the little bits of the mountain are actually made with car parts from a magazine. So I just really like the juxtaposition and the way he's thinking through the really long-term history of Ladakh in this way that ties it to the earth itself. And there's a feeling of belonging, even as it's also kind of looking to the future in the way that he's a very contemporary artist, a little bit, yeah, just a contemporary artist, forward-looking, really creative, fearless. I felt like it's a nice combination to be thinking about how you can be both those things, tied to your past, but also thinking through your relationship to the future.
Hmm. No, that is indeed wonderful, because it also brings me back to, you know, how you open your text with also telling us about how even the idea of Ladakh itself, right, as a region or as a demarcated territory, is also such, also happens more sort of aggressively during the colonial and then sort of the post-colonial period, before which even to conceptualize it as a demarcated territory is difficult, because it's such embedded in such a large network of trade and trade routes and mobility and mobility of people and goods, that it's sort of this, you know, not a bounded region, so to speak. So I understand how this cover art appeals to your sense of a deep history of Ladakh. Thank you so much, Sarah, for your time today. I've taken up a lot of it already. But before we let you go, I would love to hear from you about your next project. You've already told us bits and bobs about it in the course of the conversation. But if you would like to share with us, what is it that you are working on and what can we expect to see next? I'm sure it'd be a delight.
Sure. Thank you. It's hard to wrap up, because I'm doing a bunch of collaborative work, especially with colleagues and my PhD students. So I'm lucky to work with some really wonderful PhD students, and I'm doing sort of different projects with each of them, related more to trying to understand some of the same themes, but in different contexts. So that is one strand of my current work, where I'm trying to understand racial capitalism and internal colonialism in the context of the U.S., especially with Pavitra Vasudevan, now at UT Austin, and another student of mine, Carlos Serrano and Pallavi Gupta. We're talking about racial capitalism and different kind of how it unfolds in different places. So I'm trying to take some of these themes and look at them across contexts. So I've also been writing about the U.S. and the right-wing fascism of Donald Trump, the way that's also tied to a kind of gendered geopolitics of white masculinity come to defend and subjugate others. So that's one strand. But then with Mabel, I have this ongoing project about college students. So that we're wrapping up now, and we have a list of things that we're writing about young people in relation to the urban as a specific kind of site and the ways that cities can be folded into one's personal narrative. We're also trying to understand the relationships between things like racialization and scheduled tribe status and the ways that tribal affiliations were laid out in the Constitution, also in relation to kind of colonial anthropology and how those questions are related to time, like who's understood to be immovable in time and how people are positioned in relation to the state in ways that are tied to racialization and also to the idea of tribal. So I'm working on sort of an array of projects like that, also trying to think about like race and racialization in relation to the future. So Mabel and Pavitra and I have wrote about that in relation to the Anthropocene. I think it can seem like I'm sort of a scattered mess of a person with little bits of things all over. What I'm really trying to understand is how we're making the world in relation to these categories of race and gender, and then how big political movements are also tied to our kind of daily life in terms of how we're making the world through our relationships with others.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for saying that. As an anthropologist, I deeply appreciate studying about making the world in and the ways in which it is related deeply and perhaps very, very intimately to our own lives, and not just to sort of the mega spectacles of you know, the political stage or the geopolitical stage in this case. Thank you so much, Sarah, for your time. This was a lovely conversation. All the best for your next series of projects, and we hope to talk to you with the next big splash.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely talking to you, and I also can't wait to read your book.
All right then. Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye.